want to, if you want to pretend, pretend. It's fine. I'm all for pretending. I like pretending. I pretend I'm good looking every morning when I look in the mirror. It's cool. But it doesn't make it so. I mean, just because you pretend doesn't make it so.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, Tony, you know good and well, it's no coincidence she's just suddenly getting this award now.
I'm going to run a special block for her tomorrow in honor of that fact. Not tomorrow, but Thursday on the blog, with her condemning words against the University of Tennessee, your Cusida Hall of Famer.
You think she'd come on our shows?
Lifetime achievement. I think she's got to be gag ordered.
You ought to invite her.
I don't want to talk to her. I'd yell and scream at her. It wouldn't be good.
Oh,
I'll tell you who I wouldn't mind talking to, though. The more I think about it, is not right. But you know what? Her 15 minutes is up. You don't even hear anything about that now. There's so many layers to crazy in that thing. You don't even hear about her.
Oh, no. The thing's going to blow up. It's going to be the student judicial stuff. It's going to be where
people have no idea what we're talking about. People today were like, why are you spending any time talking about this? I'm going, because in 3 weeks, it's all anybody's going to be talking about when they figure out what's going on. But let's go back to our phones.
Yeah, when the Tim Rogers, Jenny Wright stuff hit.
And Tim Rogers? People are going, you can't settle it. Let me tell you something. You take that thing down the track, and you're not going to like what comes at you. I've seen it. And here's the thing about it. Any major university, any major institution this size, how many skeletons are in the closet? Not just here. Anywhere. Let's go to the phones. Hello and welcome in to our next caller.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, welcome in.
Hey, it's Dustin. What's going on?
Hey, buddy. Good talk to you.
I missed the ball. How you doing, Keith?
Good, fine, Justin.
Good, good. I missed the ball game tonight. I had some of my softball stuff to do with my daughter, but
proud of you.
You know, Hub's probably coming back next year, right?
No, I don't know that.
I'd be stunned.
I mean, really, he's probably going to come back. I mean,
No, I don't know that. And if I were you, I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't count on that.
I don't either.
I'm just telling you, I wouldn't count on that.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. But, you know, if he does come back,
mm-hmm.
he's going to be a key guy. He's going to be the key guy that makes us better.
The only way you get him back is if you sit down with him and you look him in the eye. You know, seriously. And he says to you, Coach, I'm 100% for the first time in my life, I'm 100% on board with somebody here.
Tony, I bet he's told people that before. How in the world can you trust that kid now? I'm sorry.
I wouldn't.
I feel sorry for him because he was overrated at the beginning and he's got this thing about him where he's just laid back and he's not who people want him to be, and that's too bad for him.
There have been plenty of great basketball players that are laid back, Tony. He's lazy. There's a difference.
Yeah, you got a point there. He is lazy. I feel sorry for the kid, too.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of offensive talent.
I think he does.
Offensive ability is unreal, but anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out at you tonight. He's got a good show. Keep it up.
You know, thanks, man. Good hearing from you, and kudos to you for spending time with your daughter. That's much more important, obviously, than this.
Yeah, I think DCS probably gets called on any parents that chose to watch this instead of spend time with their kids.
After our signing period in the fall, Keith, somebody's asking about scholarship openings. Right now, Tennessee's landlocked.
Yeah, technically, we're out right now.
So technically, the answer is none.
And we're chasing Yurt 7. Have offered Bowden, and I'm sure that
there's one more.
Every intention of taking advantage. They've offered Adonis De La Rosa.
Correct.
I'm sure they'll take a senior transfer big man if one becomes available.
So there's a good three. I mean, I'm just going to speculate here. Okay. I think the Canadian kid's probably not going to be here. simply because it just hasn't gone for him like he thought it was going to. You know, I don't know if I'm ready to commit on Hubs in terms of him not being here.
I guess, like I said earlier, Tony, there are four guys who I'm confident will have that are on campus right now that will have a scholarship next year. I wouldn't with any confidence say anybody else is going to be there. Once you get past, like I said, Turner, Phillips, Schofield, and Alexander,
I agree with that.
I think everybody else, I can't see Kasongo being back.
No, I think it's probably an upset if he's back, just kind of getting the backstory there.
I can't see him being back. I think he's giving Mostella every opportunity, but one of the reasons he's doing that right now is he didn't have any other option. Put it this way, if Kevin Punter's healthy enough to go Saturday, I don't think we'll see a hell of a lot of Dietrich Mostella.
He's a coin flip.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, I think you have to at some point for Rick Barnes. We disagree, and I know a lot of times you're just having fun. You don't take a job when you got the wins and the money and stuff he's got now. You don't take a job just to ride it out and get more big checks. Rick Barnes doesn't need any more big checks. Guys, you're not going to win with guys like Hubs and Mostella who are here one night, going tomorrow night. You're not going to win with those guys. And when you're 60-something years old and you've got 600 wins,
yeah,
and you've got enough money to run through the next 10 generations of your family, you're not going to mess around with that. My guess is Barnes' one motivation right now professionally is to get this up and running and look back at Texas and give them a middle finger. I think that's about the extent of his professional motivation now.
To the phones we go.
I'm not going
to
do that with those guys.
Let's get our next call in. And by the way, Mark Davenport on my Periscope tonight has been like a little gnat circling around my head on a sultry July evening, like a little gnat. And I'm getting ready to reach in there and smash it and slap the guts out of it. Let's go to the phones. Rochette!
Hey, Tony, buddy. Hey, buddy. How's it going, buddy?
Ring it. Ring it to the table, my friend. How you doing? I'm pumping you up. I'm giving you major ups here, major propers.
Uh-huh.
Welcome in. And may I say to you that your...
Yeah.
Your display at the sushi spot the last time we were there,
yeah,
inspired me. You know what I did?
Thank you.
You know what I did?
What did you do?
Went the other day and I had 4 plates of fried rice with nothing else.
Wow. Huh.
I'm on your diet.
Surprising.
There's the low carb diet and then there's the Raj diet.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Huh. Well. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Roger. How you doing today?
Doing fine. How's it going, Keith?
Yeah, doing great, Roger. Thanks for asking.
Oh, sure. No problem.
Hey, Roger, I share something with you?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, sure.
This is Doc. Tonight, thinking about the Vols getting beat. You think that tore at his heart like that, Raj?
What now?
You think he cares? It tears my heart up to see us lose like that.
Yeah, of course. His heart is, you know. Of course it is, you know.
You know what tears his heart out?
Yeah, of course it does, you know.
Well, Lady Vols take the court and they get this. You do realize, Raj, you do I'm talking to you through my paper now. The Lady Vols, how do I sound with this filter on my microphone, Raj? The Lady Vols, for the first time, did not have a first or second team postseason player.
Oh, wow.
In the SEC, Raj. First time ever.
Really? Wow, really?
That's got to be killing the doc. Does he rip them on his show? Because I listen to Swain. I don't listen to him. Do they? Does he rip him on his show?
No, really. He just kind of don't understand the team a little bit, you know.
He's a hater.
He's
a hater.
Cloney's listening right now.
Cloney just texted me. He wants you to do a little doc. And I'm getting way back here, Raj. I'm away from the console now.
Outstanding.
Are you doing me right now, Raj?
Outstanding. Outstanding. Remember, I love that word, Tony. So,
Hatfield, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think Roger is usually stealing the show.
Roger, you know what I got to say about your imitation of me?
What's that, Tony? That's outstanding.
Outstanding.
Keith, Raj,
I'm trying to distract you so we don't talk about that crap tonight.
I know, and you're
going to go back to the game now.
Yeah, but
that's not what we're doing here. We're not going to talk about the game. This is a post-game show, Roger. We're not talking about the game on here.
That's why you have a show after. No, actually it isn't.
We're 4 games under 500. We're devolving. Yeah. We got blowed out tonight at Vanderbilt.
True.
We have 2.5 players.
Yeah.
Our upperclassmen are either banged up or they've quit.
Really?
Or a combination of the four.
Yeah.
And you're wanting to break the game down?
Yeah, I want to ask Keith how does that team, the pin, and hang on, Raj.
Yeah. APB, Don from Sweetwater, we need an update on your grandson. Go ahead, Raj.
Alright, Keith, how does the team get the 10 points and all of a sudden it get back up to 20 point, make a big run, Keith? How does that happen? The team was not that good. Yeah. Do you get that, Tony? Same thing Keith saying?
Roger, Roger, I can't in good conscience talk any more about tonight's game. I tried to get out of here 45 minutes ago.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
I mean, I love you. I love you. I asked you to talk about the game. Can't we talk about something else? You want to talk about some fishing?
Yeah.
I guess that'll be okay.
Yeah. You gonna do your show anywhere tomorrow, Tony?
Don't ask me no more questions, and I won't tell you no lies. Where am I gonna be tomorrow? I'm at Copper Cellar on Cumberland Avenue.
Okay.
You coming down?
I don't know. I have to ask my friend about it.
Okay. I would give you a ride tomorrow, but I'm leaving out of here early because I got to head over to Blount County in the morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's okay. I'm saying, honey.
I would give you a ride in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Keith, do you think the Ravens think he's doing good coaching field?
Yeah, well, I think he's on the worst job in the league.
Really?
Keith, do you think he's done a good... That's a great question for Keith.
Yeah.
Keith, do you think Rick Barnes has done a good job this year?
Yeah.
He's gotten out of this team, pretty much what anybody else would have gotten out of him.
Yeah.
I don't think he's done anything above what anybody would have done, but I don't think he's done anything worse than anybody else would have done. I just don't think it's a very good basketball team.
I guess you gotta have more time.
Everybody listening to the sound of your voice tonight thinks he needs more time, with the exception of one listener, Raj.
Who's that?
His initials are WJ. Do you know who WJ is, Raj?
Let's see.
Hatfield, who's WJ, Hatfield?
You got me on that one.
Well, his first name is Whiny.
Oh, Jamie.
He wasn't fired the day that he was hired, though, because he wants everybody fired the day they're hired.
Did he start calling the Opelika County shows wanting the guy fired for losing 20 games his first year last year?
He's happy. The day that the jobless numbers come out when they're up.
Him and
Small Mind. Those are their two favorite days. Small Mind calls the Nashville shows attacking me.
I rent space in his mind.
I rent space in your little mind.
Let's rip him for a second, Raj.
Go ahead.
Why does he have to whine?
I don't know.
You know,
it's a great question.
I thought, you know, it's a great.
If Whiny Jamie called right now, Raj, we'd three-way him and we'd ask him about our. No offense, Jamie.
No offense. I was just curious about why you want to fire a coach. He has given time. I know he's not been great, but his first year, they're getting better a lot.
No question. I mean, to me, there are 14 teams in this league, and I'd rank the job performance he's done so far 14.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
So let me ask you this. Let's go back to Whiny Jamie real quick.
All right.
Are you familiar with the Cattlemen's Act?
Cattleman's Act.
Remember the Cattleman?
Sure,
do you remember him, the Cattleman?
Yeah.
What'd you think of him as a caller?
I think he's funny, but I think he's a little bit personal.
He does take it personal.
He's funny, though. It's funny in a way.
What about Jeker? What do you think of Jeker?
I like Jeker. He can be crazy sometimes. How he talks sometimes, kind of funny crazy. How he talks sometimes, you know.
He sounds like he's had sometimes. some He sounds like he's taking too many aspirin in his day.
Yeah.
What did Luke tell us the other night, Keith? What was the reason we weren't playing well? Luke told us something.
He was afraid that our guys had been he wanted to know if the reason we were inconsistent was if we were taking too many aspirin.
Oh. Well.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Raj, what to make?
Yeah.
What to make of your phone call tonight?
Oh, really? Don't want to make it, huh? I don't either. Keith, will you take a make him up? Would make him a phone call, Keith?
Oh, I think it's 5-star as always, Roger.
What do you make him a phone call?
You classy the place up.
Huh?
You classy the place up. We need that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, come on. Let's be honest, Tony. We essentially made him follow a flushing toilet.
Raj, yeah. I think you've had a great call. A 5-star. As somebody said. You went all the way to 5-star. 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, all the way to 5-star. You want 5-star. Let's work on your
outstanding. Outstanding. Tony, where do you get all your words at?
God.
You get some great words.
God. Let's do next level. Ready? Next level.
Next level.
Pretty good.
How's that?
Do some Doc now. Doc is really your comfort zone because he is he's a worm. Raj, I love you so much, man.
Thanks for being there.
Hey, that was fun tonight.
Yeah, it's fun talking to y'all. See y'all.
See you, buddy.
Have a good one. See you. Bye-bye.
Hatfield, give me a final thought and tell them who you were presented by on the way out. And it was beautiful tonight. We stretched this thing into an extra hour. We just did an hour and a half on that game that I will describe as pure crap on a cracker.
I'll take out of his text a friend sent me during the show. He said that baseline view at Memorial Gym gave a true Vanderbilt fan's perspective as you were looking at the back of a rich white guy's head.
And that rich white guy was?
Rick Barnes.
Thank you very little. And on the way out, that is your
Fancy Tavern and Whiskey House, Tony. Fancy Tavern and Whiskey House. You knew what was coming.
What's your drink de jour down there?
I've been drinking a lot of Miller High Life lately, Tony. Can I go back to my blue collar?
You're going to Clancy's Tavern and Whiskey House. If you're drinking a whiskey drink, recommend something for me.
Oh no, I just go Jameson straight. That goes
Jameson straight. I want to go down there and play some tunes one night. Can you get me in?
I don't think that'd be a problem at all, Tony. They kind of have a bluegrass jam in there every Sunday evening.
No, I don't play some like jazz stuff. I don't play bluegrass.
Those bluegrass
guys are too good for me. It's too fast.
I'll hook you up, Tony. Hey, you want to come in and play some tunes? We'll set you up on the stage.
All right. Keith, I need you to look into the microphone, and I need you to look to Turkey, wherever you are. We got to do this tonight. We do this every night, and I got to bring him home. I feel led tonight. It's on my heart. It's been put on my heart by Raj tonight to say this. As I get on my app called Periscope, for those of you at TonyBasilio.com, if you've never been on it, you can literally look over the whole world. And as I go over to places like Uzbekistan and Pakistan, and if I go to Australia, I've gone too far. You can go just a
fast crackistan.
Skip over a continent. I want to look to a guy that we want. Now, a famous American musical philosopher once said, "She's like rolling a Yerk 7. every time you roll the dice. And I want to say to Yerk 7, sir, in these parts we call you Turkey. We will not baste you. We will not broil you. We will love you. We will savor.
Yeah, this is going to help.
We will savor
this is gonna help.
The flavor.
Oh, Lord.
Yerk 7, if you're listening, wherever you are, Turkey, we're hungry. This fan base is hungry for Turkey. Thank you, Hatfield. It was a lot of fun tonight.
Always is, Tony. Always is. Enjoyed it.
You're a goofball. Thank you. Thank you for joining us this evening. No matter where you may be, wherever you're listening, wherever you are, I want you to know something. We're going to get through this together. This has been a great labor of love. We might only be doing this a couple more times, which is really hard for me to believe. It kind of breaks my heart. It really does. Because March Madness is getting ready to happen, and it's getting ready to happen without us. It's getting ready to happen without us. And that doesn't make me feel like Barney tonight. I don't feel like Barney. I love you. And you love me. But I don't feel like Barney tonight. To them. I want to thank my friends, Smartway. And your Garza Law Firm. It has been a tremendous, tremendous time being with you tonight. An absolutely tremendous time being with you. You want your mind blown? Listen to this. It is a real honor, a privilege, and a blessing to visit with him. His new book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger, and the World That Made Him. TJ English is our guest on Book Corner. TJ, thank you for joining. Great pleasure to visit with you.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's always great to have a voice in the great state, Tennessee.
You are the author of also Patty Whacked and Havana Nocturne. The way you start this book out, there are so many ripples, so many lives this guy affected.
Yes, absolutely. Not just Bulger, but I would say the arrangement that was created in the criminal justice system in New England that gave Whitey Bulger his power, or at least facilitated his rise. That's a story that implicates a lot of people other than just Whitey Bulger. In fact, by the time I got around to writing this book, you know, there had been previous books about Bulger, biographies of Bulger, a book called Black Mass that was adapted into a film with Johnny Depp. I felt that the story was not so much about Whitey Bulger, or maybe there was nothing left to say about Whitey Bulger that hadn't already been said, but what hadn't really been addressed is Bulger's role as a confidential informant with the FBI and the criminal justice system, the Department of Justice, based in Washington, D.C., how that facilitated his rise to power, and how he was kept out on the street to commit heinous crimes. He's charged with 19 murders. And that his base of power was partly a consequence of a corrupt relationship with a corrupt system. And that was the part that needed to be detailed.
And you start out with an individual who is, he's lost his freedom. He's been framed. He's in jail. And that spoke to me right away. I thought I picked this book up to read about Whitey Bulger, but you make the case early on in the book. If that's what you picked this book up for, that's not what you're going to get. What you are going to get is, here are the lives that
that this guy, that's why I started out with the just the ripple effect of everything that he did. I can't believe the role of our government in that. It's disgraceful.
Well, here's the moral of that story. When you get down in the mud with pigs, you wind up as a pig. And I think that what happened in New England, and this is not just New England, this is the way the criminal justice system operates in the United States of America. It's highly dependent on the use of informants. This exists at all levels of the system, the use of informants. And so agents, cops enter into relationships with criminals in the interest of gathering information, theoretically, to use against other criminals. This is a largely unexamined facet. It's popular in movies and crime novels, but it goes largely unexamined within the criminal justice system itself. And so the Bulger story needed to be put in the proper historical context. And that context was that these corrupt relationships between agents and gangsters in New England had existed long before Whitey Bulger ever even came on the scene. In fact, Bulger inherited those relationships. And so I needed to go back in time to the mid-1960s and show how this framework of agents entering into dirty little relationships with criminals and how that framework was set and how Bulger plugged into that framework and then played it for all it was worth, utilized it, manipulated it, whatever you want to call it, but he didn't create it. He didn't invent it. That was in place before he came along.
You hooked me on page two, so congratulations.
We're talking about a guy named Joe Salvati.
Yes.
Joe Salvati was a guy who was framed for a murder he didn't commit. He was framed by a gangster informant witness named Joe Barboza, notorious mob figure from New England in the 1960s. The FBI cultivated Barboza the same way they would cultivate Bulger many years later. And they used him to make cases against the mafia, against the Italians. That's how you made your career in law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
You made cases against the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And so Barboza was the guy who was going to help them do that. And he was going to take the stand in various trials. And he took the stand in a murder trial and fingered four innocent men for a murder they didn't commit. And he did that with the compliance of his FBI handlers, and they knew what he was doing, and it was authorized all the way up the chain of command to J. Edgar Hoover. Now, we didn't know this at the time, of course, and it came out many, many decades later when the Whitey Bulger story exploded in public domain, and the Pandora's box was opened, and a lot of the dirty little details from going back half a century started to come out, and one of them was the framing of these innocent men. So I tracked down Joe Salvati, who was released after spending 30 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And I felt it was important to open the book with him for the reasons you just mentioned, you know, the human consequences of the corruption that existed there for 45 years.
I put myself in his position. I'm sitting there thinking, TJ, and I told you before, you're so talented because you have the ability to take us there. And people who are blessed with the written word can do that. And kudos for that. And when I say you hooked me on page two, I'm sitting there as you're recounting this guy's story and how it goes all the way to Hoover, that they knew they were sending innocent men to jail. It was like shrapnel. Their lives, truly, didn't matter to these people. And then part of me says, what must it have been like for that man to be sitting in jail knowing I didn't do this? And how many more of him are out there that we don't know about because there's not a Whitey Bulger to tip us off? Did you have that thought at all as you were putting this book together?
Oh yeah. I had many thoughts like that. I was haunted by the Joe Salvati story. I mean, not only was he framed knowingly by people within the criminal justice system, but in later years, whenever he tried to prove his innocence, whenever he tried to get his lawyers, tried to gather evidence to present before parole boards to prove his innocence, he met nothing but resistance from the government, from the FBI, and from the Department of Justice, because they knew that dirty little secret was buried deep within the system. And they were engaged in a cover-up to make sure that it would never be known. What was done would never be known. And this, by the way, to bring it back to Bulger, the reason this dirty little history was so important to me was it answers the question, why was Bulger so untouchable
mm-hmm.
when he was out on the street? And mm-hmm. part of that was Bulger forged a relationship as an informant with the FBI knowing this history. He knew this history. Everyone in the criminal world knew these guys had been framed for a murder they didn't know. It was common knowledge. So Bulger knew that if he entered into a relationship with the FBI, he would become the custodian of this dirty history. And now he had entered into a pact with them where it was in all of their interest to keep this secret. And the fear was that if Bulger was ever busted or arrested, it would rip the scab off this wound and all this dirty history would come to the surface, which, by the way, is exactly what did happen.
Bulger, it's really interesting because the narrative you would get if you didn't know. And I listen to a lot of talk radio out of Boston. I'm kind of a talk radio freak, and I listen to a guy named Dan Ray who's on at night on WBZ. And I know you talk about another longtime radio host up there. But Whitey Bulger is somebody that you hear people in that community talk about him, even to this day, has his defenders. He didn't put drugs on his own people. He kept it clean. He was kind of a good criminal, if there is such a thing. And the point you make in the book is no. No, and no, he's a dark-hearted, dark criminal, don't fool yourself, but he acted with impunity because he did all this with the blessing of our government. You make the point in the book that people died. People died, and our government knew that he was still killing people, and they still did business with him.
I think the reason for that is that they feared that this dirty history would come out. Protecting Bulger became the same thing as protecting this dirty history from coming out. And that's what was behind it all those years. And Bulger was aware of that, and he played that. And we might also mention that his brother was arguably the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts, president of the Massachusetts State Senate. For 16 years, his rise to power in the political world paralleled Whitey's rise to power in the criminal world. And so, you know, Bulger felt that he had it covered, and he did in a number of areas. You know, he had his brother in politics. He had the FBI in his pocket, so to speak. And that's why for 20 years as a mob boss in Boston, that guy never got so much as a parking ticket.
What's incredible to me, though, what I couldn't wrap my brain around was I would think in my simple mind, this is me now, okay? If I'm in law enforcement and I'm cultivating a relationship with a bad guy and he's an informant, wouldn't at some point I say to that person, hey, you know, when push comes to shove, while we're developing you, could you at least refrain from your criminal activity? Could you at least refrain from murder? Could you at least... But Bulger never saw himself as an informant. And that's a distinction that has to be made, right? He never saw himself. And they let him live in that little world, didn't they?
Yeah, I think his handler, John Connolly, who was from the same neighborhood of South Boston, kind of knew the Bulger brothers growing up, particularly the politician brother, Billy Bulger. Connolly was close to him and worked on Billy Bulger's political campaigns. He was Whitey's handler. And, you know, Whitey was the big white whale. Getting Whitey was a big feather in his cap.
Yep.
And he cultivated a relationship with Whitey where Whitey was allowed to believe whatever he wanted to believe. I'm sure Whitey said something to the effect, I'm not a rat, you know, and if you ever say that I worked with you, I'll deny it, and I'll never take the stand. He laid down his terms for what he believed the arrangement was, and Connolly said, sure, absolutely, whatever you say. And then they proceeded to trade information, and it was mostly Whitey giving Connolly information And then Connolly, of course, was also giving Whitey information that, by the way, led directly to murders.
Murders!
Led directly to murders. And in fact, murders of people who were also cooperating witnesses that were going to be used to make a case against Whitey. Those were some of the people Whitey was murdering. So it was a sweet arrangement for Bulger. What makes the Bulger story so extraordinary is that he had manipulated himself into this unprecedented kind of series of relationships that allowed him to stay out there. But again, as I try to detail in this book, he could not have done it without a corrupt system that had been in place for a long time.
We visit with T.J. English, where the bodies were buried, Whitey Bulger and the world that made him. And this is a you-will-not-be-able-to-put-it-down book. I mean, the more you read, the more you get into this thing, and the characters come to life, and in some cases, they go under their deaths. Let's go back. We're back in that period where the FBI is protecting Whitey Bulger, and you're talking about this issue with him and how he's just doing business as he does it. But there are people inside the FBI during this time, particularly one guy from Houston, and I can't recall his name off the top of my head, but he's transferred into Boston. He's an outsider. He's unfamiliar with the arrangement, but he knows right away when he's around Whitey Bulger, there's something wrong with him, wrong with this deal, and he wants to shut him down as an informant. He wants to shut him down, which means in the FBI world, that's it, we're done with you. But there's no way that was going to happen. If you can, unpack some of that for me.
Yeah, that's a good point. There were people within the system who smelled a bad stink in the Bulger arrangement, and they were usually outsiders who would be assigned to the Boston division of the FBI, and they'd come in and they'd quickly get a sense that this Bulger guy was untouchable. If anyone tried to open a case against him or any agent was getting information from an informant about Bulger and they'd bring it into the office, all of a sudden their files would disappear or their case would get shut down. They were meeting a weird and eerie kind of resistance from within the system that they couldn't put their finger on. They couldn't identify. I always compare it to that movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, the people around you have been taken over by the alien force, but you can't tell by looking at them because they look and act just like anyone else. And when you get into trouble, you turn to them thinking they're going to help you, and it turns out they're in on the conspiracy. And that was the case because there were some very high-placed people within the system that were benefiting greatly from having Bulger as an informant. There were the FBI agents, and there was also a very aggressive U.S. attorney in that area named Jeremiah O'Sullivan. He was kind of the New England version of Rudy Giuliani. He was making big cases against the mafia, and his rising career was based on that. And so these people protected Bulger. And if anyone within the system tried to take Bulger down or go after Bulger, their investigations were sabotaged. They were sabotaged from within. What happened over time is everyone up there just became defeated by it. It was sort of a dirty little secret in the entire jurisdiction of New England that Bulger had some kind of arrangement with the FBI, and because of that, he was untouchable. And this was particularly disheartening because bodies were dropping. People were getting murdered. And then they started getting murdered even outside of Boston area. Murder in Miami, a murder in Tulsa, Oklahoma, all of it related to the Bulger organization. So this thing was metastasizing and becoming bigger than anyone could control.
Meanwhile, our federal government, the FBI, knows in some cases that hits are coming. They basically watch this stuff go down. And you talk in the book about how there were a couple of women who died and just met cruel deaths at the hands of this madman. And speaking of Whitey Bulger, he knew he was going to get away with it. And basically he killed these women, you say in the book, why? Because he could. There really wasn't any reason to kill these women other than they'd become a nuisance. But that's what it became for him. I mean, it was almost like he was God.
Yeah, he and his partner, Steve Fleming, who was also a homicidal maniac and also an FBI informant and had been even before Bulger was, In fact, I think Clemmie is one of the ones that encouraged Bolger to become an informant because he knew what a benefit it could be. These guys were killing people left and right over a period of a couple decades, and they were getting away with it. And I think what happened is they developed delusions of grandeur. They started committing murders that really didn't have anything to do with business. The murders of these two young women, one of them was an ex-girlfriend of Fleming's, and the other was Fleming's stepdaughter, who he was having a sexual relationship with, and they feared that she was going to talk about that. So they lured her to a house, and Bolger strangled her to death with his bare hand. The level of violence is horrifying. But yeah, I think these guys came to believe they were God, that they could kill whoever they wanted to kill and get away with it. And the reason they believed that was because they had for 20 years.
And looking at your book, it's way worse than that trial was depicted. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
After digging into it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was probably the main reason I wrote the book. You know, when Bolger went on the run, he in 95, he got tipped off that his FBI guy had now retired, and he was no longer an informant, so he was somewhat unprotected. And the DEA was about to indict him and arrest him, and his old FBI handler got word of that and tipped him off. Bolger went on the run. We didn't see him again for 16 years. He was discovered out in Santa Monica, California, with his girlfriend, and he was brought back to Boston and put on trial. My agent approached me around that time because I've written a couple previous books about different aspects of the Irish-American mob in the United States, a book called The Westies and also Paddywhacked, which, by the way, when they did arrest Bolger in Santa Monica, that book was on his bookshelf right next to his bed. So he was a guy, and he's mentioned in that book, mm-hmm. Bolger's a guy who was well aware of his image and sort of cultivating his image. Anyway, they brought him back, and my agent suggested that I write a book on it, and I said no. There had been many books written about Bolger, and I just didn't think there was anything left to say. But I was going to cover the trial as a journalist and do a series of reports for the Daily Beast website. And as the trial began to take shape, it became clear to me that a kind of a cover-up or a whitewash was taking place, that the government had a problem at prosecuting Whitey Bolger for his crimes was the easy, because he'd been on the run for so long, a lot of evidence had been amassed, and a lot of his former associates made deals with the government and become witnesses and would be testifying against him. So prosecuting him for his crimes, 19 murders, all the other crimes, racketeering, was the easy part. The hard part was for the government to keep the Bolger narrative from spilling over yep. into areas that would be embarrassing to them.
Yep.
And that had to do with his relationship with the system and who had protected him. And in fact, that he had been protected by Jeremiah O'Sullivan, who became the U.S. attorney, the exact same office that was now prosecuting Bolger, had a corrupt relationship with Bolger. And so I began to see the trial as a very carefully orchestrated cover-up of the larger context of the Bolger story, and that's really when I felt that there was a book that not only could be written but needed to be written.
And the more you dug, I can imagine, it was probably like the gift that kept on giving. I mean, at some point you had to say to yourself, there's no way in hell all this is true.
Yeah, it was shocking. It's still shocking to me. I mean, we were talking about Joe Salvati being framed and that it was authorized all the way up to Hoover. When I tell that story to people, they look at me like I'm making it up.
No, nobody wants to believe that. Right. Nobody wants
yeah,
to believe that.
Yeah, they look